Hello, this is your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan, bringing you the April 7th edition of The New Yorker magazine. Today's main story is the Senate's Age of Irrelevance. The political scene, the Senate's Age of Irrelevance. Elon Musk's DOGE and Trump's executive orders are pushing Congress's upper chambers from ineffectiveness to obsolescence. Will John Thune, the new majority leader, let them? By David D. Kirkpatrick. On January 8th, in an ornate hall of the United States Capitol, five Republican senators stood behind President-elect Donald Trump as he talked to the Capitol Hill press. Four listened impassively, but John Thune could hardly stand still. As Trump began describing a love fest in Greenland over his plans to annex it, Thune turned away as though distracted by oncoming footsteps. He crossed his arms, stared at his feet, rocked from side to side, moved his hands in and out of his pockets, and fidgeted with his suit jacket as Trump spewed falsehoods that the diversion of water for a tiny little fish had kept Los Angeles from putting out fires, that illegal immigrants were mainly murderers or mental patients, that China was running the Panama Canal. After Trump left, Thune, who was about to take over as the leader of the Senate's new majority, gamely echoed the president's insistence that Republicans stood united on his agenda. Yet Thune, as he often does, subjected that agenda to notable edits, making Trump's platform sound like that of a Reagan-era Republican, bolstering the military, bringing down taxes, securing the border, producing more energy. He said nothing about Trump's signature policies, across-the-board tariffs, mass deportations, a purge of the deep state, pressing Ukraine to end its fight against Russia, pulling away from NATO. Asked about Trump's wildly impractical campaign promise to stop taxing tips, Thune said only that the idea was on the table. Would Trump's priorities be packaged in one big bill or two staggered ones? And which chamber would take the lead? All this was an ongoing conversation, I'll put it that way, Thune said, as an aide hurried him off. Thune, a fourth-term senator from South Dakota, is an awkward leader for Trump's ruthless Republican Party, in part because even Democrats invariably describe him as amiable and honest. A senior Democratic aide told me that Thune is incapable of lying. Kevin Wister, a former reporter from the Sioux Falls Argus Leader, who covered Thune for decades, told me that the senator used to hold weekly conference calls with South Dakota journalists. When Thune tried to sell Republican talking points about the perfidy of whatever Democrats were doing, Wister recalled, "I'd ask him, but John, Republicans really did the same thing, didn't they?" And he'd say, "Yeah, we're really at fault too." That's true. Who does that? Before Thune became the party leader, journalists would crowd the hallway outside his Capitol office. Unlike Mitch McConnell, the taciturn and cunning leader at the time, Thune genuinely tried to answer questions. He was seldom cutting or caustic and rarely tossed off a memorable line that might begin or end a newspaper article. As a veteran congressional reporter told me, Thune could be counted on for a reliable middle quote. A Republican aide who knows Thune described him to me as hyper-competitive but also Midwestern nice. Southern nice, like Mike Johnson, the Louisiana Republican who was the Speaker of the House, can be double-edged, as in bless your heart. Lamar Alexander, a former Republican senator from Tennessee and a friend of Thune's, noted a contrast between him and the two most recent majority leaders, McConnell and the Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer. Those men are renowned for their guile, and when you don't think of guile, when you think of John Thune. We sat down in mid-March for an interview in Thune's grand new office, and I asked him how he communicated with Trump, given their differences in style and substance. Very carefully, he said with a chuckle. Did he find it difficult to work with a president so little concerned with accuracy? Well, I mean, we're very different personalities, Thune said. A very big personality and a very boring Midwesterner. He argued that Trump had qualities very useful for his job, such as enormous stamina. Although Trump is beginning his second term as president, Thune expressed sympathy for him as somebody who hasn't been around a legislative body for any length of time, and for whom, in some ways, it is all a little bit of a foreign language. Thune said that he ran for leader to be a bridge to the White House. He added, I've always felt like I can sort of get along with anybody, noting that his relationship with Trump on a personal level has gotten more comfortable over time. He concluded, I'm straight with him and he's straight with me. Thune's candor often stood out in the course of Trump's rise to power. During the 2016 race, Thune condemned Trump's expressions of bigotry as inappropriate. After the leak of the Access Hollywood video on which Trump boasted about grabbing women by the genitals, Thune was one of the first Republican senators to demand that Trump quit the race immediately, though the election was only a month away. And even after Trump's victory, Thune never masked his opposition to the president's most cherished plans. In a 2017 television interview, he objected to the mass deportation of illegal immigrants, adding that a lot of my colleagues shared his view. He has called across-the-board tariffs a recipe for increased inflation that would punish South Dakota farmers and ranchers by setting off trade wars. He has consistently stood with what he calls our trusted intel community on the conclusion that Russia indeed meddled to help Trump in the 2016 election. He has called Vladimir Putin a murderous thug whose invasion of Ukraine proved the value of NATO. Thune often praises wind energy, a booming industry in his home state, even though Trump considers turbines loathsome eyesores. Trump's demand that Congress refuse to certify Joe Biden's 2020 election win elicited one of Thune's few memorable turns of phrase. He told journalists that the request would go down like a shot dog in the Senate. After January 6th, Thune called Trump's role in the riot inexcusable. Linda Duba, a friend from South Dakota and a retired Democratic state legislator whose children used to run in track meets alongside Thune's, told me that she once asked him what working with Trump was like. Not fun, Thune had said. Another old friend was blunt. I think he thinks Trump's an ass. Trump, for his part, used to mock Thune as a McConnell lackey, Mitch's boy. After the shot dog comment, Trump accused Thune of weakness and sought to back a primary challenge against him. Trump mouthpieces tried to block Thune's ascent to party leader. Tucker Carlson, for example, declared that Thune hated Trump and what he ran on. The senators, though, kept their ballots secret. Without fear of Trump's retribution, they chose Thune by a vote of 29-24. The selection of a non-MAGA party leader suggested that Senate Republicans may not be as reflexively devoted to Trump as many liberals assume. It was also a measure of the senators' cynicism. Thune represents what they might stand for if Trump weren't looking. Yet the gap between the senators' private votes and their public fealty to Trump also poses a risk to Thune's status as leader. With each biennial congressional election, more MAGA diehards have joined the Senate, while Reagan-Bush holdovers have left or reinvented themselves as America First converts. Given Trump's towering popularity among GOP primary voters, only a handful of the 53 Republican senators have been willing to risk even a slight public break with him. And were the president to turn against Thune again, some MAGA true believers would surely be eager to replace him. John Barrasso, a Wyoming senator who was considered a leading contender to succeed McConnell, now serves as the second-ranking Republican in the chamber. After the November election, he staked out his position as a MAGA champion by declaring, while standing next to Thune at a press conference, that Trump's return marked the remaking of the Republican Party for the better. When Thune gave his first floor speech as Senate leader, he pledged, in effect, to stand up to the president. He vowed to preserve the filibuster, a Senate rule that checks the power of a majority by requiring 60 votes to cut off debate and get almost anything done. It would take only a simple majority to change the rule if the majority leader scheduled a vote on it, and Trump, during his first term, unsuccessfully demanded some 30 times that McConnell and the Republican do so. It is axiomatic in Capitol Hill that Trump will resume that push the next time the Democrats use the filibuster to thwart him. To everyone's surprise, however, the new Trump administration has made the filibuster almost beside the point. Instead of trying to bulldoze the Senate, Trump has simply driven around it. He has sought to govern by fiat through executive orders, brazenly ignoring federal spending statutes and daring courts to try to stop him. Several Republican senators told me they worried that Congress, paralyzed by decades of partisan gridlock, have already ceded too much of its power to the executive branch. As Elon Musk's so-called Department of Government Efficiency swings its chainsaw through congressionally mandated federal spending, Trump is now threatening to push the legislature from ineffectiveness to obsolescence. In the mid-March interview, Thune acknowledged that, right now, there's a tension between the Senate and the executive branch. He said several times that the Trump administration was testing limits, including through stuff that DOGE is doing. Yet Thune insisted that the Senate has a unique role in our democracy, and our job is to defend that role, and at times, if necessary, to push back. DOGE's handiwork will get litigated, he predicted, and at the end of the day, the structure works, and I think the institutions stay standing. Thune, in other words, was counting on the judicial branch to protect the legislative branch. Saxby Chambliss, a former Republican senator from Georgia and a friend of Thune's, who talks to him often, told me that Thune is ready for adversarial conversations with Trump, and that he will be as tough as he needs to be. Joe Manchin, the Democrat-turned-independent former senator from West Virginia and another close friend of Thune's, agreed. He said that, with MAGA loyalists now dominating the House of Representatives and the Democrats flailing at one another over their own impotence, Thune was the keeper of the seal. It would be up to Thune alone to convince the White House that we have three equal and independent branches of government. In a city aptly described as Hollywood for ugly people, Thune could pass for an actual movie star with pale blue eyes, a square jaw, and Mount Rushmore cheekbones. Now 64, he has salt and pepper hair that is still thick enough to part neatly on the side, and the broad shoulders, thick arms, and narrow waist of a basketball player. His morning workout at the Senate gym are legendary. Until a recent knee injury, Thune held the informal title of the fastest man in Congress. He has likened that honor to the best surfer in Kansas. The phrases "looks the part" and "central casting" came up in nearly every conversation about him. John McCain, a two-time presidential contender, used to joke that he would have won the White House had he looked like Thune. The South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham, who's liked to respond that John McCain's wife Cindy would be happier too, told me that Thune is a guy you really want to hate. So tall, good-looking, beautiful wife, but you can't because he is so genuinely nice. Some journalists who cover the Capitol have given Thune the nickname Hot Grandpa. Thune's physicality played a role in the chance encounter that started his political career. He grew up in the tiny town of Murdo, South Dakota, the fourth of five children. His father, a decorated Navy vet, who'd been a star basketball player for the University of Minnesota, taught and coached at the town high school, where Thune's mother was the librarian. High school sports were virtually the only entertainment in town. Bruce Renard, a friend of Thune's, whose family owns an auto repair shop there, told me, in those days, if you wanted to be somebody, you showed it on the basketball court, on the football field, on the track. Thune was a standout in all three sports. In one high school basketball game, he sank 5 of 6 3-throws. Later at a store, he ran into Jim Abner, a Republican congressman from a nearby town who often turned up to cheer for high school sports teams. "I noticed you missed one," Abner teased him. Thune's parents were Democrats, but Thune became Abner's protege. In 1980, the year Ronald Reagan first won the presidency, Abner took George McGovern's Senate seat. Thune, who'd graduated from high school the previous year and followed his older brothers to Biola University, an evangelical school near L.A., volunteered for the campaign. After earning a business degree at the University of South Dakota in 1984, he joined Abner's Senate office as a legislative aide focused on tax policy. Abner, who never married, hired a series of young men from South Dakota, forming a kind of surrogate family. Some lived with him in his apartment near Washington, working as a combination of a driver and an aide. They called themselves the Little Abners. Abner lost his seat to Tom Daschle in 1984, and Thune followed his mentor to the Small Business Administration. Abner's connections then set Thune up for a series of political jobs back home, including state railroad director and executive director of the South Dakota Republican Party. He was elected to the House at the age of 35 and ran for the Senate 6 years later, in 2002, against the Democratic incumbent Tom Johnson. In retrospect, the parallels to the 2020 presidential campaign are uncanny. Thune led by more than 3,000 votes on election night, but by morning, the tables had turned. Late returns showed an unusually high turnout on a large Ogallala Sioux reservation. Thune lost the race by just 524 votes. South Dakota is sometimes called the Mississippi of the North because of pervasive racism towards its Native American minority. Operatives and donors urged Thune to demand a recount, reasoning that even if the effort failed, allegations of reservation ballot stuffing would galvanize the party's base, much as President Trump's allegations of voter fraud in predominantly black cities energized his core supporters in 2020. But Abner, who was serving as an advisor to the Senate campaign, had always preached a more high-minded politics, and Thune decided to concede. Lee Schoenbach, a former Little Abner who volunteered on the Senate campaign, told me that supporters went out and made affidavits and did all the things that happened in 2020, and John just said, "No, I am not doing it." Several Little Abners who keep in touch with one another told me that most of them disdained Trump's incivility and lawlessness. Schoenbach said, "The attack on America's Capitol is something I don't think Jim Abner could have ever gotten over, and that is all I am going to say about it." 2 years after losing the 2002 race, Thune challenged and beat Daschle, and then the Democratic leader. In his victory speech, Thune addressed Abner, "Jim, we got your seat back." Thune arrived in Congress at a time that now looks like a high point of its power and effectiveness. In the 90s, lawmakers debated issues, committees drafted bills, and the parties compromised to tackle urgent problems. Congress sent presidents George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton major legislation on trade, crime, environmental protection, financial regulation, civil rights, and other issues. Negotiations between the parties even closed the deficit briefly. Philip Wallach, a fellow at the Conservative American Enterprise Institute and the author of a timely book, Why Congress, told me that, looking back, it's really amazing. Nothing like that has happened in the last 15 years. Wallach argues that the founders intended Congress to diffuse the kind of polarization currently vexing our politics. In the Federalist Papers, James Madison worried about what he called the violence of faction. He feared that rival parties would put their own interests ahead of the common good, that a party in the majority would tyrannize the minority, and that an all-or-nothing battle for the upper hand would tear apart the republic. Presidential elections could provide no remedy, because they are winner-take-all contests, the same is generally true of court verdicts. Congress is the sole branch of the U.S. government in which opposing factions can broker mutually acceptable solutions. In the Senate, especially, a tradition of unlimited debate, the origins of the filibuster rule, all but forced compromise by blocking a simple majority from taking action on its own. The necessity of power sharing also meant that Congress could provide a check against despotism, even if the same party held the presidency and a majority in both houses. One turning point, Wallach told me, was Newt Gingrich's Republican takeover of the House of Representatives in 1994. Gingrich relished partisan warfare, demanded loyalty from his rank and file, and turned district elections into contests between national parties. Political scientists have identified long-standing trends that have contributed to the deepening polarization of Congress, including the growing ideological homogeneity of each party and the breakdown of the media into echo chambers. But Wallach is surely correct that Congress, the branch of government designed to mediate factional conflicts, has succumbed to them and made them even worse. To more effectively wage partisan battles, Democratic and Republican leaders in both chambers consolidated their own power. Instead of relying on committees to draft bills, party leaders increasingly negotiated significant measures behind closed doors, then brought them to the floor for up or down votes, often in the form of giant must-pass bills against a tight deadline, such as measures to keep funding the government. In the Senate, the concentration of power had been especially stark. Senators used to take pride in proposing amendments during floor debates, facilitating bipartisan deal-making, even against party leaders' wishes. Yet those leaders now often block individual senators from such freelancing by allowing consideration of only a limited number of amendments, and then filling those slots with innocuous proposals of their own choosing, a tactic called filling the tree. The former Democratic Majority Leader, Harry Reid, pioneered this strategy in the 2000s, and his successors from both parties have kept it up ever since. In the Congress of 1991-92, Wallach noted the Senate adopted more than 1,600 amendments. In 2023-24, that number fell to 200. And the last Congress passed just 274 bills, down from about 700 a year during the late 80s and fewer than any Congress since before the Civil War. Of those 274 bills, the 10 longest were assembled by the party leaders, and they accounted for four-fifths of all the pages of legislation passed in that Congress. Lawmakers sometimes grouse about their loss of power. 10 years ago, Mark Begich, then a Democratic senator from Alaska, tried unsuccessfully to instigate a revolt against Reid's tree filling. Lamar Alexander, another critic of the practice, told me that being elected to the chamber now resembled joining the Grand Ole Opry and not being allowed to sing. It's very disappointing. Senator Ted Cruz of Texas complained to me that what used to be an integral part of legislating, offering amendments, changing bills on the floor, has largely disappeared. Bills are drafted privately by the leaders of both parties, and 98 other senators acquiesce to allowing two leaders to arrogate that power to themselves. He continued, Mitch McConnell ruled the conference as a monarch. He made the decisions and he shared his thinking with no one. Thune is in some ways a throwback. At a time when cable news coverage and online donations reward the noisiest partisans, he has built a reputation for quietly working in good faith with Democrats on the committees he has sat on, among them the Agriculture and Commerce. Chris Lewis, the chief executive of Public Knowledge, a left-leaning advocacy group, told me that Thune opposed its positions on most issues, but called him a straight shooter who looked for common ground on such issues as rural broadband access. Several senators told me that, at the end of last year, Thune negotiated an agreement with Democratic leaders that allowed Biden to equal the number of judicial confirmations made during the first Trump administration. In exchange, the Democrats agreed to drop a handful of liberal appellate nominations whom Republicans found especially objectionable, leaving those seats open. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, a New York Democrat who participates in a weekly Bible study with Thune, told me that he was fundamental to all the bipartisan work we did in the last cycle. For example, Thune helped initiate talks on an immigration bill, even letting legislators use his office. In the end, the bill became a classic example of a partisan paralysis. When Trump indicated that he preferred to leave the border problems unaddressed so that he could keep campaigning on the issue, the Republicans killed the legislation. In today's Senate, bipartisan committee work produces little major legislation signed into law. An unusual spate of bipartisan bills that were produced early in the Biden administration on infrastructure, semiconductor manufacturing, and gun control emerged from White House negotiations with gangs of senators informally deputized by their party leaders, not from traditional committees. As a result, Thune has few major laws to his name. In 2017, he was one of four Republican McConnell charged with hammering out an internal party consensus about a tax package. But this was an all-GOP effort passed through a 50-year-old process known as reconciliation, which allows a simple majority of senators to approve certain budget-related measures. Candidates for congressional leadership now routinely pledge to bring back regular order, committees drafting bills, amendments debated to the floor. Thune promised this too, sort of, Josh Hawley, a Missouri Republican, told me. He said that he'd seen no effort to reverse that trend and actually re-empower senators. Few lawmakers believe that such a restoration is imminent. Similarly, the tradition of the filibuster, which increases the leverage of individual senators and circumscribes the majority, has grown tenuous. Each party, when in the minority, has used the filibuster to obstruct almost any action. Then, when back on top, it has chipped away at the rule. When Democrats controlled the Senate during the Biden administration, only the opposition of a pair of moderates, Manchin and then Senator Kyrsten Sinema, saved the filibuster from extinction. Now that the Democrats can thank those two holdouts for preserving their best chance at constraining Trump. Congress, stymied by gridlock, has increasingly failed to exercise even its most vital prerogative, the authority to control taxation and spending, which is the legislative main leverage over the executive. The first article of the Constitution, enumerating the powers of Congress, stipulates that no money shall be drawn from the Treasury but in the consequence of appropriations made by law. But Congress, unable to pass annual appropriations bills, now often relies on so-called continuing resolutions that essentially extend current spending levels in order to prevent the government from running out of money. A recent study concluded that since 2012, Congress has used such resolutions nearly half the time. Wallach said, "The sense of fiscal autopilot is really profound." In his book, Wallach projected that if Congress continued to its course of the past decade, it would eventually become either a useless circus or a mere rubber stamp, in either case, ceding its authority to an increasingly dominant White House. 2 months into the second Trump administration, Wallach told me that Congress appeared to be devolving into that also ran status much faster than he'd ever imagined. You're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, the New Yorker magazine, read by your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. Moreover, after years of shrinking congressional power, the public seemed undisturbed. Imagine being a young person who has only lived in the 21st century, Wallach said. How seriously could you really take the idea that all policy is supposed to come from Congress? The executive branch seems like the originator of all the most important policies going back your whole political consciousness. Trump's attempts to ignore or bully Congress look like a natural progression, not an aberration. If Trump says, "I am going to embrace the idea that the White House is in charge and get a lot done," I don't know how shocking that is to the people, he went on. The Republicans in control of Congress, he noted, had so far barely mustered any opposition to Trump's strong-arming. If we follow this trajectory, Congress will certainly be more marginally than ever before in American history. When factional loyalty supersedes all, a president whose party controls Congress hardly needs to worry about the courts, which have little enforcement muscle of their own. A president determined to go it alone could arbitrarily hand out or withhold federal grants, contracts, and jobs, impose or remove selective tariffs, according to whim, exploit his public office for personal profit, promote friends' interests, direct or squash criminal prosecutions, reshape regulations to benefit favored businessmen. In fact, Trump has already attempted all of these things. A president unencumbered by congressional oversight might wield such powers over media companies, universities, labor unions, trade associations, and the donors to advocacy groups or political campaigns. By rewarding obeisance and muffling dissent, he could make voting out the ruling party more and more difficult. That is how authoritarians operate around the world. Lamar Alexander reminded me of a maxim from the late Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia, the conservative icon. Scalia said that in every Tenderhorn dictator, the president for life has a Bill of Rights. It's the separation of power that has kept Americans free. When Trump first took office in 2017, Thune joined other Republican congressional leaders in what amounted to an opportunistic bargain. They basically ignored the new president's falsehoods, insults, conspiracy theories, protectionism, xenophobia, and the rest of it. In exchange, they tried to capitalize on his supporters' passion in order to score GOP victories on issues such as tax cuts and judicial confirmations. With characteristic forthrightness, Thune, who was then the third-ranking Senate Republican, told the Times that Republicans had accepted Trump's tendency to say things on a daily basis that we're not going to like. But he added, if senators stay focused and get stuff enacted, those would be big wins. McConnell took this bargain as to a duplicitous extreme. He was publicly enthusiastic about the agenda of the new administration, but behind the scenes, he conspired daily with Paul Ryan, then the Speaker of the House, to curb Trump's impulses. Both lawmakers described their efforts in a new biography of McConnell, The Price of Power, written with his cooperation by the journalist Michael Tackett. Ryan explains that he and McConnell saw Trump as an amoral narcissist with zero regard for the Constitution who would shoot the messengers whenever they explained the limits of a president's power. McConnell gave Tackett access to private oral history recordings he made during the first Trump administration, and they are scathing. In the recordings and in later interviews, McConnell describes Trump as unfit for office, uncontrollable, not very smart, irascible, nasty, beyond erratic, stupid, and ill-tempered, a sleazeball, and despicable. After the 2020 election, McConnell said that Senate Republicans were counting the days until Trump left office. McConnell called Trump's role in the January 6 assault on the Capitol an impeachable offense, and Tackett describes the majority leader's decision to vote against impeachment anyway, on the basis that Trump had left office and voters and judges would keep him out of politics, as likely the worst political miscalculation of McConnell's career. By opening up to Tackett, McConnell essentially dropped his mask. Lindsey Graham, a former Trump critic who has reinvented himself as the president's golfing buddy, told me that McConnell had been too honest. Mitch has burned every bridge and squandered his influence, Graham told me. Thune would never do that because of his Midwestern niceness. Yet Thune, a McConnell lieutenant and confidant throughout Trump's first term, has hardly distanced himself from the former majority leader. In interviews, Thune has said that he still asks McConnell for advice, crediting him for an outsized influence on issues such as national security. In fact, the Trump takeover of the GOP so dispirited Thune that in 2022, he contemplated retiring. He lamented to journalists that too many quality people, Reagan-Bush Republicans, were leaving the Senate. If Democrats ended the filibuster, Thune added, the Senate won't be a fun place to be. A friend of Thune's told me that the senator had gone through a period of soul-searching that bordered on depression. He was asking, where did his life go, and what happened to his party? But the friend said that Thune's thoughts of retirement had collided with his feelings about January 6. Who is going to be there to certify that the votes are counted in the next election? Who is going to be there to stand against the crazies? And at the end of 2021, Senator Susan Collins, a Maine Republican, and another friend told The Times that she would be truly beside myself if Thune left the Senate. And as if to persuade him to stay, she added, We've got to plow through this to the post-Donald Trump era, which I believe is coming. Sinema, a former Arizona senator who left the Democratic Party and became an independent, is a good friend of Thune's. She told me that he stayed to protect the institution, and by the institution, I mean the American system of governance. He believes in the fundamental principles our founding fathers laid out, you know, the separation of powers. A person close to Thune told me that the senator and his wife ultimately concluded that he had more to give and wanted to leave it all in the field. In 2024, when Thune announced a bid to succeed McConnell as the leader, Trump's hostility posed the biggest obstacle. The favored MAGA candidate was Rick Scott of Florida, who had previously tried to oust McConnell. Such contests have always been settled privately among senators out of shared pride in the institution's independence, but Scott seemed to enlist MAGA celebrities to undermine Thune. He went to the podcast of the far-right provocateur Laura Loomer, and afterwards she slammed Thune on social media as a snake who wanted to kneecap Trump's second term. Musk called Thune the Democrats' favorite candidate. Tucker Carlson accused him of plotting a coup against Trump's agenda. Thune's secret weapon was a floating dinner party. For years, almost every week the Senate was in session, he gathered a rotating group of 6 to 12 fellow senators for a jovial dinner at a restaurant near the Capitol, Bistro Cacao La Loma. Thune mostly hung back and listened as his colleagues drank wine and traded gossip, jokes, and updates about their families. The dinner stood out as a rare recurring opportunity for building camaraderie among lawmakers who sometimes had little in common. Senator Mark Wayne Mullen of Oklahoma, a former mixed martial arts fighter who dropped out of college to take over his father's plumbing business, told me that at these dinners he made a surprising discovery about Cruz, an Ivy League educated lawyer known for ideological grandstanding. Ted Cruz is the funniest guy in Congress, Mullen said. If he fails at the Senate, he's got a life as a comedian. Sinema and Collins were frequent guests, as was Steve Daines, a Montana senator who was often mentioned as a potential dark horse challenger to Thune in the race for party leader. Manchin told me that Thune always graciously charged the tab to his political action committee. I jumped him one time and got to pay before he could grab it, and that those dinners became his political base. Manchin admired Thune so much that he offered to caucus with the GOP if Thune needed an extra vote to become the Republican leader. Several of these dinner companions, notably Mullen, Graham, Daines, and Senator Kevin Cramer of North Dakota, were also close to Trump. All four told me that they had undertaken a quiet campaign to help Thune win Trump over. Graham said that their message about Thune was, "He wants you to be successful and everybody likes him." In the run-up to 2024 presidential primaries, Thune voiced his hope for other options beside Trump. He eventually endorsed his fellow Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina. But behind the scenes, Thune was selling himself to the former president, too. Mullen told me that he helped coordinate the very first phone call and that Thune took it from there. After that, Mullen said, one of them would call me and say, "Hey, I just got off the phone with your buddy, and you saw a relationship develop." He argued that it testified to the character of both men, that they could bury it that quick. Thune endorsed Trump in February 2024, visited him at Mar-a-Lago the next month, and returned again in September. Trump himself never publicly backed any candidate. But by November, Mullen was discreetly suggesting that Trump was for Thune. Mullen told me if John Thune had asked Trump to endorse him, I am confident he would have. In the end, Graham said it was Thune's appearance that brought Trump around. Graham insisted to me several times that Trump liked the look. The look matters a lot to Trump. Just look at the cabinet. Trump's second inauguration carried echoes of January 6. MAGA pilgrims again converged on Washington. Trump moved his swearing-in ceremony indoors, owing to inclement weather, and the next day Republican lawmakers gave constituents tours of the Capitol. Roving bands of Trump superfans filled the halls. In their Stop the Steal regalia, many could have passed for January 6 rioters. I saw t-shirts emblazoned with mottos such as, "When tyranny becomes law, rebellion becomes duty, 1776. Stuart Rhodes, the founder of the Oath Keepers, showed up again too. He was sprung from prison on Inauguration Day when Trump pardoned everyone convicted of crimes connected to the attack. The following day, at a Dunkin' beneath the Capitol complex, Rhodes held forth to astonished journalists about the righteousness of the assault. I joined to the Capitol Press Corps, chasing Republican senators in pursuit of their honest reactions to the pardons. The mob, after all, had targeted them. Collins, pausing before she disappeared into an elevator, called it a terrible week for our justice system. And Senator Tom Tillis of North Carolina said that granting impunity for the violence made the Capitol less safe. Nearly all the others dodged the question. Evoking the January 6 riot, in some, was a fitting start to Trump's second term. He had already begun a sustained assault on the power of the legislative branch. On December 17th, Elon Musk had debuted the Department of Government Efficiency, which at the time consisted only of a month-old social media account. Thune, Johnson, and their Democratic counterparts had just worked out yet another continuing resolution to keep the government's lights on, and they'd inserted $30 billion in funding for disaster recovery. Republican aides in both chambers told me that the Trump transition team had signed off on it all. But Musk used his new account to spread misinformation about the deal, including false claims that it would give lawmakers a big pay raise and fund a bioweapons lab. By the afternoon, he threatened to back primary challengers against any Republican who voted for the resolution. "The waste and corruption will never stop," he declared, "unless at Doge ends the careers of deceitful pork-barreled politicians." Trump joined on Trump Musk's bandwagon. Then, without consulting either Thune or Johnson, he declared that any continuing resolution must also raise the limit on federal borrowing, to save him the unpleasantness of handling that chore himself when the debt reached its cap. This was an impossible demand. many House Republicans refuse on principle to vote for a debt limit adjustment. Securing one requires weeks of negotiations and Democratic cooperation on both chambers. Still, with Musk and Trump attacking the agreed-upon deal, House Republicans voted it down. Neither Thune nor Johnson dared complain. Johnson, who is widely perceived to owe his speakership to Trump's endorsement, the speaker ballots are public, even pledged to follow Trump's swerve. Trump humiliated him nonetheless, declining for weeks to assert confidence that Johnson would remain speaker. We'll see, Trump told journalists. Thune is less dependent on his favor, and Trump has opted to flatter him. At a January meeting with Senate Republicans, Trump praised Thune as very elegant, senators present told me. Trump invited Thune to sit with him and Johnson at the Army-Navy football game and named Thune's son-in-law, Luther Lindbergh, to a top Agriculture Department post. By March, Trump was calling the majority leader by a fond name, Big John. Yet Trump has tested Thune, too, in the final stage of the Senate Republican leadership race. Trump insisted that the contenders agree to support recess appointments. By installing nominees with Congress out of session, he could bypass the Senate's constitutional authority to advise and consent. Then Trump forced Senate Republicans into confirmation votes, so politically painful that they couldn't hide their discomfort. Questioning Tulsi Gabbard about her appointment as the Director of National Intelligence, Republican senators begged her to agree with them that Edward Snowden was a traitor for leaking sensitive documents, then fleeing to Moscow. During hearings on Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s nomination to be the Secretary of Health and Human Services, Senator Bill Cassidy, a Louisiana physician, prodded him to repudiate his baseless fear-mongering about vaccines. Will you reassure mothers unequivocally and without qualifications that the measles and hepatitis B vaccines do not cause autism? Both nominees refused to comply. Except for McConnell, every Republican senator acceded to Trump's wishes anyway. Trump's nominee for the Office of Management and Budget, Russell Vogt, challenged the Senate even more fundamentally. Vogt insisted that Congress did not have exclusive control over federal spending. In 1974, after President Nixon refused to spend money as directed by appropriations laws, Congress passed the Impoundment Control Act to clarify that no president can unilaterally withhold such funds. The Supreme Court confirmed the next year that the Constitution forbids it too. Yet Vogt testified that Trump had actually campaigned on the idea that the Impoundment Control Act itself was unconstitutional. Trump and Vogt were asking senators to surrender some of their most crucial power. By the time Vogt's nomination came up for a vote on February 6, Trump had openly defied spending statutes by issuing an executive order that froze trillions of dollars in federal grants and loans. He'd summarily fired 17 internal agency watchdogs, ignoring legislation that barred such terminations without cause and without notifying Congress 30 days in advance. And DOGE had grown into a shadowy team furiously slashing congressionally authorized programs and civil service jobs, starting with Musk's announcement on social media that he'd put the United States Agency for International Development through the wood chipper. Despite all this, every Republican voted for Vogt's confirmation. Trump, bucking his party's traditional commitment to free trade, has used emergency declarations to impose sweeping tariffs on Mexico, Canada, and China. He has repeatedly threatened levies and then deferred them, seemingly on impulse, sometimes after an ingratiating phone call from a CEO or a foreign leader. Even more dramatic, on February 28th, Trump abruptly upended congressionally mandated support for Ukraine. In a televised meeting, he upbraided President Vladimir Zelensky for insisting that only U.S. security guarantees would stop future Russian aggression. That morning, three Republicans had met with Zelensky in a show of solidarity. After Trump's outburst, the Republican Senator Roger Wicker of Mississippi, who chaired the Armed Service Committee, deleted a social media post celebrating his meeting with Zelensky. Thune, faced with this blitz, had so far ducked open conflict with Trump. According to Mullen and others, Thune privately explained to the president that recessed appointments were too impractical to pursue except as a last resort. The move requires majorities in both chambers to vote to adjourn simultaneously and forces the appointees to work without pay and benefits for up to 2 years. Mullen said, "I am sure the president did not understand that because I did not understand it either." But one person in particular had a very strong conversation with the president about it, and that was Leader Thune. And when was the last time you've heard the president talk about it? In public, however, Thune pledged allegiance to the idea that all options were on the table to get Trump's picks confirmed, including recess appointments. When Trump and Musk blew up the December spending deal, Thune feigned normalcy. At midnight on a Friday, minutes after the government had technically run out of money, the Senate passed what amounted to the original deal, but broken into pieces to hide the resemblance. "It is what it is," Thune said to reporters, shrugging off the needless chaos. After Trump's pardons for the January 6 attackers, Thune, speaking to reporters, grappled audibly with his instinct for honesty. "I think he needs to. I mean, as I've said, obviously, look at these things on a case-by-case basis," he stammered, repudiating the indiscriminate nature of the pardons. But in his next sentence, he said what he was focused on: the future, not on the past. Thune has protected vulnerable Republican senators from having to cast potentially embarrassing confirmation votes, but only to the extent that he could avoid crossing Trump. Mullen told me that Thune instructed Republicans to allow Collins the flexibility to vote no on some nominees, including Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth, a former Fox News host dogged by allegations of heavy drinking, sexual assault, and financial mismanagement. He denies the drinking and the assault. According to Mullen, Thune reminded his Republican colleagues that Collins, who's up for re-election next year in Maine, is probably the only Republican who can get elected to a statewide Senate seat there. Yet Thune showed less consideration for Tillis, who is seeking re-election in North Carolina, where he faces a credible Democratic opponent and may also confront a primary challenge, perhaps from Lara Trump, the president's daughter-in-law. The night before the vote, Tillis informed Thune of his plan to oppose Hegseth. He would have been the fourth Republican to vote against the nomination, thus dooming it. Thune refused to shield Tillis from Trump, forcing him to tell the president personally. That enabled Trump to pressure Tillis to vote yes, partly by threatening to back a primary opponent. Hegseth squeaked through. Both the Times and the Wall Street Journal reported Thune's role. With the senator under pressure from the right to rush confirmations, his staff had incentive to confirm the story. When Trump is outlandish, Thune often recasts the president's words and deeds in benign terms. At a luncheon after Trump's inaugural address about America's decline and horrible betrayal, Thune toasted him for capturing the optimism of President Reagan. Thune has also tried to describe Trump's arm wristing of Zelensky in nobler language. After the president called Zelensky a dictator without elections and bizarrely faulted Ukraine for Russia's invasion, Thune told reporters that Trump had merely wanted a peaceful conclusion to the war, and so did Ukraine. But the Oval Office spat with Zelensky was harder to euphemize. "Last week was a missed opportunity," he told reporters, disappearing into his office without saying who had missed it, Trump or Zelensky. When we met in mid-March, Thune told me that he had not talked to Trump about Ukraine. The president had conveyed in general terms that he is trying to achieve there. Thune said, I think he's now at least, he's starting to, he paused. There's more pressure being applied with the Russians. Thune noted in public statements, he's always been clear about who is at fault in the region and that the U.S. commitment to NATO must be ironclad. Thune has acknowledged diplomatically that he sees tariffs through a slightly different lens than the president does. But he prefers not to talk about Trump's forecasts that across-the-board tariffs will be a major long-term source of revenue, potentially to be collected by a new external revenue service. Thune has forecasts on White House statements suggesting that the levies on Canada and Mexico are intended only to push those countries to crack down on the flow of fentanyl. In television interviews, Thune confidently portrayed the new levies as targeted, a means to an end, and for a specific purpose only. When I pressed Thune about Trump's tariffs one day, as he was walking through the Capitol, he was less sanguine. I think they're hopefully temporary, he said. He crossed the ante room of his office suite while I followed him up with a question about whether or not he or the Senate could have any say in the matter. Thune stopped to think before turning back to respond that there was a lot of executive branch authority when it comes to tariffs. He sounded almost mournful. Despite Trump's systemic disregard for Congress's authority, many Republican senators, at least publicly, have brushed off worries about the separation of powers. Who is saying that? Mullen asked, asserting that only Democrats had expressed concerns. In another conversation, he insisted that DOGE was eliminating only fraud and abuse. When I asked if he thought that the entirety of USAID was fraudulent, he shot back, have you seen it? And that's all we have time for today, by Daniel D. Kirkpatrick. He's a staff writer at The New Yorker and the author of Into the Hands of Soldiers, Freedom and Chaos in Egypt and the Middle East. We are at the conclusion of this week's The New Yorker magazine program. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. Thank you for tuning in this week, and I invite you to join me next week for another new edition of The New Yorker magazine. Have a great week and stay tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona.